You don't need me to explain this. We measure one another's success, one another's worth as individuals. We say we are all, you know, into the American dream. We want to provide to our children a better standard of living than we had. And for enough generations, that was true that we all promised that to our kids, a promise we would like to deliver on. So Americans were attached to consumption. I like to use an illustration from economics, the subject I teach. If you take a basic economics course, here's what you get taught very early. You get shown it on a graph, but I won't bother you with that. And you're explained labor has attached to it something economists call disutility. That's a fancy way of saying it's a drag. Consumption has attached to it utility. I like it. So how much work do you do? Economics answers. You do it to the point where you no longer, as you do more and more hours of work a week, it becomes more and more onerous. The first hour stinks, but the 10th hour really stinks. Meanwhile, the first hour's consumption is really satisfying, but the 10th hour is not so sad. So you notice the unpleasantness of work rises while the joy of consumption falls, and where they crisscross, if you take economics, you'll discover that economists get as close as they ever get to orgasm when things cross. Okay? So they're very excited about that. Every textbook has that in there. It's a big moment in the textbook. It's really exciting. So when those two lines cross, notice what's being unspoken here. Work is negative. Consumption is positive. You should accept the horror of work. That way you spend most of your adult time between birth and death. You should accept it. You should look for your satisfaction at Walmart shopping. Now, I don't mean to be cute about it because it's very serious. But the important point, and the reason I'm stressing it to you, is in the 1970s, when wages stopped going up, you presented the American working class with a traumatic transformation. We're not raising your wages anymore. We don't have to. We're not gonna. Before I take you through what it did to the working class, which produced the crisis today, before I take you through it, I need to answer the question I know is in your minds. Why did the wages stop rising? Basically, we solved our labor shortage. Four things happened in the 1970s that ended our labor shortage. Number one, a technical change came through that substituted on a mass scale labor by having a machine instead. It's called the computer. Instead of having 50 people keeping track of how many Rice Krispies go off the shelf in the supermarket, you have a little scanning device that goes automatically by when you buy this, you know, it clicks off on that machine, and somebody, one person sitting in an office 1,000 miles away, knows exactly what your Rice Krispies situation is and whether a new shipment of boxes of the stuff have to be ordered. It's all done automatically by computer. The demand for labor shrank. Second, because of the recovery of our former competitors, Europe and Japan, from World War II, which took from the late 40s to the 70s, they were now the competitors. That's why Americans in the 70s stopped buying Chevys and Fords and all the rest and started buying Toyotas and Datsuns and VWs and all that. So the United States was being outcompeted by the returning capitalist competitor, and they solved part of the problem by moving production from the United States to places where wages were much cheaper so they could compete. So they moved jobs out of the country. Let's stay with this now. Computers meant you needed fewer jobs, and exporting your production meant you needed fewer people. So the demand for workers shrank. Meanwhile, the supply of people looking for work rose. Two reasons. One, a social revolution here having to do with women. The women's liberation. Women in massive numbers, starting in the 70s, left the home to look for paid work outside the home. There, of course, had been women who had always done that. But a whole new, millions of them, moved out of the house looking for work. And new waves of immigrants came here, particularly from Latin America, but from other parts of the world as well. So you had a big influx of women and immigrants looking for work at the same time that the corporate sector had fewer jobs it needed to have filled, partly because of the computer, partly because of export of work. End result, you don't have to give people rising wages anymore, and you don't. The wages stop rising. Here is a graph, very simple. It starts around the 1870s, and it goes right up to the present. It has two lines on it. The upper line is the productivity. How much stuff is an average worker producing in an average hour of his or her work? That keeps going up. We are a productive-driven economy. We make workers more and more productive by more machines, better machines, etc. The computer itself helping to keep this line going. You'll notice that the lower line, the line of wages, goes up for the first 100 years, and then it flattens out. The capitalist-worker relationship changes. The capitalist is suddenly able to get more surplus out of the worker. Why? How? Because the worker is made more and more productive, so the worker produces more and more stuff for the employer to sell at the end of the day. But the employer, who used to have to give the worker a rising wage for doing this, no longer has to. The surplus is simply the difference between the two lines. The difference between what in an hour you give your employer and what for that hour he gives you. Since what he gives you flattened out, stayed the same, while what you produced for him went up, the last 30 years, from the 1970s to the present, has been a time of unparalleled explosion in the profits, the surpluses garnered by capitalist employers. It was nirvana for them. It was a fantasy that even the most expensive professor in a business school would never have thought possible. 30 years of paying your workers not one bit of increase after having spent 150 years doing it. Meanwhile, getting more and more out of them. If I had a moment, if I had more time, and if I had a recording machine here, I'd play the national anthem. Just for musical interlude, that would be appropriate. Okay, I promised to tell you what happened to the working class. Very interesting. First, they were traumatized. Why were they traumatized? Because if you measure yourself in a rising standard of living that you afford with rising wages, and your wages don't rise anymore, you're no longer going to be able to do that which you think is a measure of your success, your worth. Moreover, if you can't consume more, you can't give your children the promised American dream. You can't deliver to your teenager what you told her you would give her last year on the date of her birthday. You can't do it. And for American working people, this was traumatic. But because in the 1970s and since, there was no public discussion, I will not embarrass anyone in this room by asking you whether you were even aware of the end of rising wages, that it was as dramatic. I won't. Suffice it to say, the American workers were not apprised of this. No president brought it up. No congressional debate focused our attention on it. Nothing. So the American working class went through this traumatic change as if it were a personal, individual experience, explained by personal, individual qualities. It wasn't a social change, it was a personal failure. What are the implications of this? Wow! First, with the husband no longer able to get rising wages when he works, a number of things happen. First, he can't secure his feudal household. The unspoken agreement with the wife was he provides the vacuum cleaner, the range, the refrigerator, the dishwasher. He can't do it. He can't replace the worn out one with a new one. He can't afford it. The conditions of his feudal household begin to break down. How does the family react? Tensions grow. Wife will deliver a surplus, unaware of it, but she wants something in exchange, which he can't give her anymore. Rising standard of living. Can't take care of the kids. Can't get them the extra lessons. Can't do it. Tensions rise. Footnote. Starting in the 1970s, the divorce rate in the United States goes through the roof. We become the country with the highest rate of divorce in the advanced world, a position I believe we still hold. One of the things the working class family does to try to cope with the end of rising wages, committed as it is to rising consumption, because that's its raison d'etre, its self-affirmation, is it sends more members of the household out to work. Retired people get a part-time job. Teenagers are sent out to work. But women, that's again the big group, sent out. The woman changes from the notion I'm going to be a housewife to the notion I'm going to have a job just like the husband. She goes out to work. But because of the long culture of a traditional household, the husband doesn't pick up the labor at home since she can't do it, since she's working. And so she goes to work and then come home and still expected to take care of the kids, to clean the place. And then a friend of mine, a wonderful professor of sociology at the University of California in Berkeley named Arlie Hochschild, writes a whole series of books, one of which is called The Double Shift. And it's about the impact on women of having added a double shift, added the shift in paid labor to the already heavy shift they had at home for unpaid labor. And that stretches the woman beyond endurance. Largest consumer of drugs in the world are the adult American women. Way outstripping the men, and way outstripping anybody else in the world, period. What's that about? Our families are riven by spouse abuse, child abuse, drug abuse. Blah. Are we peculiar people? I don't think so. I think we put our households under unbearable pressure through this mechanism. And to make a long story short, and to use Marxian analysis, the feudal class structure of the household disintegrated in the last 30 years. Alienation between husband and wife, alienation between parents and children, the ability of this situation to hold, and we now have huge numbers of divorce, huge numbers of people choosing not to resume a married life in the traditional way. They can't stand it. Fastest growing type of household in the United States for the last 10 years, single adult person in the home. What is that about? It's the end of a class. We've had a revolution in one of the class structures of the United States, but nobody, and the saddest thing is that it's the Marxist left, nobody noticed. Nobody addressed it. Oh, let me change that. Somebody in our culture did address the trauma of the working class as its families and households fell apart. But the sadness of our culture is it was the right wing Christians and Republicans who figured it out. They didn't use Marxist theory. Heaven knows. And I chose heaven carefully here. Heaven knows. They analyzed it as a loss of morality, as a failure to value the family. You know, family values, all of that. But at least then and now, they speak to a real revolutionary crisis. The left does not know how to do that, even though it has a class analysis that would give it a brilliant way to explain it and a whole different set of solutions. Did sending the women out, did sending the teenagers out, did sending the retired people out solve the problem? Did it allow families to keep on consuming even though their wages went up? Answer is basically no. And the reason is that quickly it was discovered that for the wife to go out and work, they had a whole new set of expenses. It was very, very disappointing. She had to have another set of clothes, because what you wear at home and what you wear in the job are not the same. Because we have no public transportation, they had to get a second car. Because she could no longer do the physical work of cooking, she had to buy prepared food on the way home at the prepared food joint. You know the story. All of those things are expensive. They literally ate up the extra income her paid labor brought in. So it didn't solve the problem of allowing consumption to rise for everybody in the family because it didn't suffice. So the American working class, starting in the 70s, had to find another way to allow consumption to keep going up when the wages didn't do it. And they found it. It's called debt. The American working class went on a borrowing binge no working class had ever gone under, had underway before in the history of the world. By the way, since then, several countries around the world have copied the United States and gone into comparable debt. The British, the Irish, the South Koreans, interesting group that did it. Many didn't. Germany didn't, for example. In any case, Americans went. First, they used up all their savings. In the 1960s, we had a high savings rate. Americans saved a good portion of their income. Starting in the 70s, that went down, and for the 90s, we didn't save anything. We had a zero, and indeed a negative saving rate. So first we used up our savings as a working class, and then we borrowed. We borrowed, and we borrowed. And you know, for 20 years, it allowed consumption to go up. Now, it was the consumption of people who realized they were living on borrowed time. So they wanted to consume more and more, but they knew they had to get cheaper stuff. And it created a whole new industry that didn't exist 30 years ago. The industry, which I will use a technical term for, that delivers to the American people, right? Specialized and whole countries are devoted to producing cheap for the United States. The number one country that proves to be the brilliant one that seized the potential is the People's Republic of China, which goes to work to become the greatest factory producer in the world, which it now is. But of course, the Chinese have a basic problem. They can only produce the stuff. They can't get it into the homes of Americans. They have no distribution system here. If they set up little shops all over the United States in which Chinese people did the work, it would take them years to do it, and everybody would be nervous about buying there. So they needed a partner. And they found an obscure little department store born in Bentonville, Arkansas, by the name of Walmart. Walmart and China struck a deal. I am not making this up, so please. Struck a deal. Walmart wanted to become a major department store. It is today the number one retailer in the world. It is the largest private employer in the United States. It went from nothing to absolute dominance. And it did that only because, and in the forever in the debt of the People's Republic of China. Walmart is a communist plot. Okay? The Chinese found a distributor. The Walmart found the cheap stuff. And the American workers did the rest, unborrowed. So now we come to 2007, looking at the working class, and what do we got? A destroyed class structure of the home, with all the trauma, psychological, personal, physical even. We are an obese culture. We have a lot of problems that have a lot to do with the breakup of the class structure of the home. We also have a working class that is working way too hard. Little fact for you. The OECD, a very important agency that measures economic trends around the world, keeps a record, a number of average hours worked per year by workers in different countries. We are number one. Americans work more hours per year than the Japanese, the Canadians, the British, the French, the Italians, the Germans, you name it. And the difference between us and the Germans and the French and the Italians, for example, 20%. They work 20% fewer hours per year than we do. We are exhausted as a people, physically exhausted. Because of the breakdown of the class structure of our households, we are emotionally stressed. And by 2007, we were carrying a level of debt that is unsupportable. You can't keep borrowing while your wages don't go anywhere because you have to pay it back. And the more you borrow, the bigger the cost of paying it back with interest. So you're building up a debt and not building up the basis to pay the debt. Hello? You got a problem here. And it's only a matter of time. In 2007, we got to the end of this game, as millions of working people couldn't pay their debts. They couldn't. They couldn't pay the house mortgage. They couldn't pay the credit card debt. They couldn't pay their student loan. They couldn't keep up their car payments. They couldn't. They, not because they were not frugal, not because they were unwise in their purchases. Stop. I just gave you a 150-year history that brings us to that point. Blaming somebody in the light of that history is childish. To complete the story, let's look at the other side. I've been telling you about the workers. What about the capitalists? Well, starting in the 1970s, because they no longer had to raise wages, they made a fortune as workers produced more and more for the boss, but he didn't have to pay them anymore. What did the capitalists do? This is just as important in shaping the crisis as what the workers did that I've just gone through with you. But it is, of course, a Marxist analysis to tell the story around the relationship between the worker who produces the surplus and the capitalist who gets and distributes it. The surplus of capitalists went crazy, starting in the 70s. The first thing that the capitalists did, and for those of you that follow the financial press, you may enjoy this. The first thing that the capitalists did was to take a huge portion of the surplus enabled by no longer having to pay rising wages and pay it to themselves as huge salaries, bonuses, and commissions. Way more than they had paid themselves in the previous 150 years. But the genius of these folks was to say, and to justify taking this money and paying it to themselves in spectacular wages, spectacular bonuses. You know, you now read about them. By the way, you read about them now, 30 years late. This has been going on for 30 years in American corporate leadership. Americans are angry now, but it really is kind of late. How did the corporations justify this to themselves? As follows. We are making stunning profits because of our genius entrepreneurial skill. What? Yeah. We ought to be paid because it's our understanding of capitalism. It's our freedom here in America where we don't have a socialist government, we don't have high taxes. See, we have low taxes and average. They told a wonderful story that made them the heroes of the piece. That's one of the reasons you couldn't be told that this wage story is all you need to understand it. They weren't geniuses. They were just cashing in on the good fortune of the end of a labor shortage in this country. But of course they had to tell the story about how it was their genius, because how else could you justify the sudden spectacular increase in their salaries, stock options, bonuses, and everything else? So that's the first thing. Second thing, with this much money, corporations could undertake a very expensive act. You know, we talk glibly about moving production out of Toledo, Ohio, and into Taiwan, or out of Scarsdale, well, wrong choice, out of Mount Vernon and over to Southern Europe. But to move production is very expensive. Very, very expensive. And companies often don't do it because you'd have to make a lot more profit for a long time in the other place to win back the cost of the move itself. Well, if you're suddenly flush with cash, you have the money. The movement out became very spectacular, and we all began to discuss outsourcing, the massive movement of jobs out of the United States, which this profit. Third, this amount of money floating in the coffers of corporations, this amount of money now accumulating in the bank accounts of CEOs and shareholders and all the people cashing in on this bonanza, created a desire of the new rich. And you really have to understand the last 30 years as having produced a new kind of gilded age. It's what it was called in the United States at the end of the 19th century. At the end of the 19th century, we also had an explosion of capitalists with names you all learned. Rockefeller, Carnegie, Mellon, those kinds of names. We have a whole new set of names now, of a whole new generation of them. Bill Gates, you know the names. So they have tons of money, and they need that money managed for them. and it becomes incredibly lucrative because they have wild amounts. So there begins to be an explosion of an industry catering to this explosion of wealthy people. And why? Because catering to anyone else in the United States is a no-win proposition. The American working people have no money. And what they have, they're spending in Walmart. So the profits to be made are to be pandering to these people. So a whole industry pandering to, what is it they want? They already have all the cars they can use. What they want, what they need, is people to profitably manage and invest their money. And so we have something called financialization, the explosion of the finance industry. Thousands of corporations with funny names, but they're all about the same thing, investing money for rich people. The most famous name, hedge fund. That's what it does. It invests the money of rich people. If you've never dealt with a hedge fund, it means you're not one of those people. A reality that may already have dawned on you. Okay? Now, hedge funds, who explode in number, there are whole blocks in New York City that's what it is. Hundreds, thousands of hedge funds in various parts of New York. Okay. The way hedge funds work is they compete for the money of rich people. You're a hedge fund, you want the rich person to give you 10, 20, 50 million that you can then invest because you get a big cut of whatever you do for him. All right? So the financial industry goes crazy. Millions of these funds are set up. Banks set them up because rich people don't want to put their money in the bank. That's what everybody does. They want a specialized hedge fund, a specialized investment counselor, a specialized all that. So an industry develops and an industry competes for rich people's money. And this industry does two things of importance in the last 30 years. Number one, it invents all new kinds of instruments that people can invest in. New gimmicks, new ideas. Credit default swaps, asset-backed securities. I'll mention a few of them. We don't have the time to go into them, but if you look at some of the literature I told you about, you will find it all described there. Not only does it invent new ones, but it comes up with the best one. And I always like to explain this one because it summarizes the whole story. These investment management companies came up with a brilliant idea. They said to the rich people, you know what? Here's a thing we can do with the money that you've gotten, because wages don't have to be paid higher anymore and productivity is rising. Here's something. The working class is desperate to continue consumption, but they haven't the wage increases to do it. They need loans. They need to borrow, and you've got a lot of money. So here's what we'll do. The rich will lend it to the workers, which is what they did. When I told you that the American working class went on a borrowing binge, it should have occurred to you, but who lent it to them? And the answer is, the capitalists lent it to them. They lent them all the money. Because it meant that the working class now was funding the capitalists two ways. First, by working and producing without having more wages. And secondly, by paying interest to the same people for the loans that substituted for the rising wages you used to get. At this point, I'd play the national anthem again. Because this is a genius way of organizing capitalism. This is genius. For a while. But it's only genius so long as you can keep it going. It's like something called a Ponzi scheme. You can keep it going until you can't anymore. And then, welcome Mr. Madoff. We don't have a Mr. Madoff, we have something much worse. We have the end of this. They took unbelievable chances, each hedge fund, to get money promised a higher and higher rate of return. So they had to find more Americans to lend to. So they lent to people who couldn't possibly pay it back. But for a while, it worked. So the capitalists, in the wild euphoria of this money, thinking themselves geniuses to have figured out a new way to have capitalism that is so profitable that will last forever, they bid the stock market up, 1980 to 2000, fastest run-up in stocks in the history of the stock market. Okay, so the stock market, they believed their own story. They had discovered, in the words of Alan Greenspan, then the head of the Federal Reserve, we living in a new economy. What he meant was not one that goes down and up, just up. Beware of anybody who tells you life always goes up. This is a person to turn around and leave quickly. Bad advice. By the way, Mr. Greenspan, to his credit, now admits he made basic mistakes. A little late, but look, most of the rest of them don't even admit that. So by 2007, these people had invested their money in much too risky a way, in a helter-skelter euphoria of it can't go wrong, producing all kinds of new instruments that nobody could even track. The government couldn't supervise. It was kind of out of control. And the whole house of cards, which was in the end dependent on the borrowing of the mass of the working class, collapsed. Marx, if he were standing here, would really enjoy the irony. The system is set off by the endless struggle of capitalists and workers. The capitalists had a chance to stop paying rising wages. They jumped, and in the process, they killed the goose that lays the egg. A famous radical once said, capitalists are so blind that they will sell to the hangman the noose that will eventually be placed around their necks. Here you have a system that is so built on the tension between workers and capitalists, on the need to get as much surplus and to have it, and is driven in its own competitive neurosis, that it will produce a situation, and now there is no escape. All that you have been seeing during the last three quarters of the year 2009, the so-called recovery of the newspapers, has been the government stepping in to try to bail out this disaster. The second major collapse of capitalism since the 1930s. I mean, the last one was the Great Depression. In 75 years, this system has collapsed two times, basically. And between the 1930s depression and the current one, we had 12 business cycle downturns. This is a level of instability where the only reasonable question is to ask of the people, why do you accept to live like this? In worry about what it'll do to your job, your family, your future, your chances. If you lived with a roommate who was as unstable as capitalism, you'd find a new roommate or demand that that roommate get professional help. But the mass of people who live in capitalism stay there and think there's nothing wrong with the system. Now that's an achievement, that level of ideological befuddlement. So, the recovery did what? The government came in, didn't waste any time on its own ideology. Remember the ideology of the 30 years, 1970 to 2000, and 40 years to 2010. Basic ideology was private sector is dynamic and good, government is a drag. Hello? In 2007, the private sector collapses, and who does it call in to save it? The government. The big bad government is the only thing that can save us, and the bankers bring them in. And the government dutifully, having been called by the bankers, gives it to the bankers. Bails them out of their, and the hedge funds, all of them, bailed out. Huge amounts of money given to banks. Huge amounts of money pushed into the stock market. And the banks come back. And the stock market has risen 45 or 50% from March, its low in 2009, to today. Dramatic recovery. But only a dramatic recovery of the banks. What about the underlying problem? Are wages going up again? No. Are workers able to consume more? No. Are more members of the family going out to work? No, less are. Has anything been done about the basis out of which this story came? No. Over the 9 months in which the stock market went up and banks came back, the level of unemployment in the United States grew without interruption. Unemployment in the United States was in 2007, in December, was 7 million people. Today it's 16 million people. 300,000 people are facing foreclosure actions in court every month. New ones starting. Americans are losing their homes and their jobs at a record number. You should none of you be surprised that the mass of people feel completely alienated from the political establishment and everything else. Of course they go to tea parties. Anybody who's willing to throw a dart at the government and at business is listened to. So much so that I, a person like me, has done more public speaking and work on radio and television in the last 12 months than in my entire previous life here in the United States. Because even someone like me explaining it in this way is now listened to, has an audience. So I don't see any exit here. I don't think there is a recovery. I think there is a great deal of things going on. Bailouts of banks, bailouts of big insurance companies like AIG, bailouts of companies that are defunct like General Motors, and so on. But mostly what the government is doing is a major theater of action. What's actually happening is that capitalism is going through a major crisis. And there will be unemployment, for a long time until wages get driven down enough that employers will begin to hire us again because we're cheaper. And they'll hire us again because with so many companies going out of business, getting office space will be cheaper. Getting secondhand office equipment will be cheaper. Everything is becoming cheaper. And that's how capitalism works. Its crises wipe out businesses, unemployed people, driving down the cost of business until once again it's profitable for business to... And the problem is only that while we wait, 1 year, 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, there may be political change in the population. That's dangerous. And how that will be dealt with as it begins to show itself now, and that's what the Tea Parties are. Unfortunately, only from the right, because the left hasn't figured out, even though this story is made for us, how to make an argument that takes this all in a different direction. So I don't expect solution. And it's my Marxian class analysis that made it possible for me to tell you this story. It's that framework that told me where to look for the statistics, that told me what factors to focus on, that helped me put them together. If you found this story interesting, if it made sense, if it gave you a picture, a feeling about this crisis, its roots in our economy, its trajectory, that isn't me. It's the Marxian class analytic that makes this story possible. And it also explains why this story hasn't been produced by people working with other frameworks, those you see on CNN or CBS or any place else, or in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, or unfortunately, in the Nation, I can continue. The problem is we need to revive and reapply Marxian class analysis because of what it did in the past and what it can do now, which is why we have this course at the Bright Forum now. In the remaining weeks, three more, we will be analyzing, as you know from the syllabus, other phenomena using this class analysis. And I think you will see when we analyze the rise and fall of the Soviet Union, when we analyze households, when we analyze the history of the working class and of labor unions and radical organizations, we're going to use this class analysis. You're going to see very interesting. You may not be persuaded by all of them. That's not really my goal. My goal is to illustrate, to exemplify, to prove to you that not having been taught a Marxian class analysis, not having learned how to use it, how to apply it, has simply deprived you and all the people you interact with from ways of understanding their own situations. That's a tragedy in terms of the lost political opportunities that might have been realized had that been done. Even now, with a crisis as terrible as this one is, we see a specter in which the left wing of the United States, of which I'm a part, cannot come up with anything like a serious intellectual argument about what caused this problem and about what has to be done about it. So we're left making vague gestures like, let me quote you, there ought to be a bigger stimulus program. Or stop. Who is this government? An independent agency that we appeal to? You got to be kidding. Over the last 30 years, as workers had no wage increases and capitalists got a lot of money, guess what happened? Workers, with no wages to go up, with their families falling apart for the reasons I went through with you, with women going out to work, with everybody exhausted, here's one of the things they did. They stopped participating in American politics. They withdrew. There's a wonderful book I've mentioned many times, I want to mention to you before, written by a Harvard professor named Robert Putnam. The book is called Bowling Alone. It was a bestseller. He's not a Marxist or anything like that. He's a sociologist who documents how, over the last 30 years, Americans stopped doing things with other people. They turned inward. They didn't go bowling in leagues, which was once a big activity. Now, they bowl alone. That's the idea of the title. They withdrew from church. They withdrew from civic associations. They withdrew from politics. At the same time that the working class withdrew, the capitalists were floating in money. So they used their money to buy the politicians. So the ask yourself, if you were a state senator in Boise, Idaho, or wherever, you had a working class that wasn't coming to your meetings anymore, that didn't care, didn't pay attention, didn't know what you were doing. But an army of well-paid lobbyists sent by business who followed your every move, who knew whose bed you were in and shouldn't have been, when, who knew how to give you support at the time of your election, who could help you in every... Did American politics turn to the right? No. The mass of Americans withdrew from political involvement. They don't care anymore. They haven't got the space and the time. At the same time that the other half of this equation moved in to make politics serve them. And that's why it works that way. In other words, here is a class analysis of the change in politics. Instead of asking yourself, what happened? Why did American working people become right-wing? They didn't. They withdrew. They withdrew. They don't care. They either don't bother to vote, which we see, or they wait until the night before, look at TV, and vote for one or the other. But what the hell difference does it make? Which is not an argument that there aren't differences between Republicans and Democrats. It may be an argument about, I haven't paid enough attention, I don't notice any difference. Which is true enough. If you don't pay a lot of attention, you won't notice much difference. So a class analysis could be the vehicle, a Marxian class analysis, that would allow us to begin to understand what happened and to frame an argument. When we turn later in this course to looking at the household again in great detail, as we're going to do, I'm going to be able to present you, hopefully you will be persuaded by it, but in any case, persuade you with a whole program for the collapsed American family and household that comes out of a class analysis, and that is radically different from a right-wing celebration of some ancient family values or cutting off abortion or all the other things that they create as their solution that will make us all go back to the happy family we once had. And you'll see the radically different way that a class analytic comes up with it. We don't know whether the American people would respond enormously, a little, or in between to a leftist analysis. And the reason we don't know is no one is putting it out there.
Now, I would say, don't put yourself down, Richard Wolff. You're putting it out there. I'm putting the message further. David Graeber's got a fairly congruent analysis. I think a lot of people are getting the message. The commercially controlled media stooges will be the last people who will ever suggest there's anything wrong with the money system. That is a dying beast. More and more people I know never expect any truth from commercially controlled media. They go other places. Now, we're going to return to David Graeber. Going to give us a couple of minutes of repeat of his discussion of the vast machine to perpetuate hopelessness, because I think it fits so congruently, fits so nicely with Richard Wolff's analysis, the larger picture of the takeover of finance capital, now pulling the strings of the political, the commercial, the media, trying to create an image of globalization as a done deal, trying to suggest that, of course, we need to have a war on terror, we need to have a war on drugs. All of this intelligence agencies, all of that is somehow, according to this worldview, utterly necessary, when I keep finding more and more people who are rejecting the whole lot, saying borders, passports, what on earth was that supposed to protect people from? Surely humanity can do better than this. And now here's David Graeber on that vast apparatus to perpetuate hopelessness. Maintaining this apparatus seems even more important to exponents of the free market even than maintaining any sort of viable market economy. How else can one explain what happened in the former Soviet Union? One would ordinarily have imagined that the end of the Cold War would have led to the dismantling of the army and the KGB and the rebuilding of factories. But in fact, what happened was precisely the other way round. This is just an extreme example of what has been happening everywhere. Economically, the apparatus is pure deadweight. All the guns, surveillance cameras, and propaganda engines are extraordinarily expensive and really produce nothing. And no doubt, it's yet another element dragging the entire capitalist system down, along with producing the illusion of an endless capitalist future that laid the groundwork for the endless bubbles to begin with. Finance capital became the buying and selling of chunks of that future, and economic freedom, for most of us, was reduced to the right to buy and sell a small piece of one's permanent subordination. In other words, there seems to have been a profound contradiction between the political imperative of establishing capitalism as the only possible way to manage anything and capitalism's own unacknowledged need to limit its future horizons lest speculation, predictably, go haywire. Once it did, and the whole machine imploded, we were left in a strange situation of not being able to even imagine any other way that things might be arranged. About the only thing we can imagine is catastrophe. To begin to free ourselves, the first thing we need to do is to see ourselves again as historical actors, as people who can make a difference in the course of world events. This is exactly what the militarization of history is trying to take away. Even if we are at the beginning of the turn of a very long historical cycle, it's still largely up to us to determine how it's going to turn out. For instance, the last time we shifted from a bullion economy to one of virtual credit money, at the end of the Axial Age and the beginning of the Middle Ages, the immediate shift was experienced largely as a series of great catastrophes. Will it be the same this time round? Presumably, a lot depends on how consciously we set out to ensure that it won't be. Will a return to virtual money lead to a move away from empires and of vast standing armies, and to the creation of larger structures limiting the depredations of creditors? There is good reason to believe that all these things will happen, and if humanity is to survive, they will probably have to. But we have no idea how long it'll take, or what, if it does, it would really look like. Capitalism has transformed the world in many ways that are clearly irreversible. What I've been trying to do in this book is not so much to propose a vision of what precisely the next age will be like, but to throw open perspectives, enlarge our sense of possibilities, to begin to ask what it would mean to start thinking on a breadth and with a grandeur appropriate to the times. Let me give an example. I've spoken of two cycles of popular movement since World War II. The first, 1945 to 1978, about demanding the rights of national citizenship. And the second, 1978 to 2008, over access to capitalism itself. It seems significant here that in the Middle East, in the first round, those popular movements that most directly challenged the global status quo tended to be inspired by Marxism. In the second, largely, some variation on radical Islam. Considering that Islam has always placed debt at the center of its social doctrines, it's easy to understand the appeal. But why not throw things open even more widely? Over the last 5,000 years, there have been at least two occasions when major, dramatic moral and financial innovations have emerged from the country we now refer to as Iraq. The first was the invention of interest-bearing debt, perhaps sometime around 3000 BC. The second, around 800 AD, the development of the first sophisticated commercial system that explicitly rejected it. Is it possible that we're due for another? For most Americans, it will seem an odd question, since most Americans are used to thinking of Iraqis either as victims or fanatics. That is how occupying powers always think about the people they occupy. But it's worthy of note that the most prominent working-class Islamist movement opposed to the U.S. occupation, the Sadrists, take their name from one of the founders of contemporary Islamic economics, Muhammad Bakir al-Sadr. True, much of what has since come to pass for Islamic economics nowadays has proved decidedly unimpressive. Certainly, in no sense does it pose a direct challenge to capitalism. Still, one has to assume that among popular movements of this sort, all kinds of interesting conversations about, say, the status of wage labour must be taking place, or perhaps it's naive to look for any new breakthrough from the puritanical legacy of the old patriarchal rebellion. Perhaps it will come out of feminism, or Islamic feminism, or from some as yet completely unexpected quarter. Who's to say? The one thing that's clear is that new ideas won't emerge without the jettisoning of much of our accustomed categories of thought, which have become mostly sheer dead weight, if not intrinsic parts of the very apparatus of hopelessness, and formulating new categories of thought. This is why I spent so much of this book talking about the market, but also about the false choice between state and market that so monopolized political ideology for the last centuries that it made it difficult to argue about anything else. The real history of markets is nothing like what we've been taught to think it is. The earlier markets that we're able to observe appear to be spillovers, more or less, side effects of the elaborate administrative systems of ancient Mesopotamia. They operated primarily on credit. Cash markets arose through war, again, largely through tax and tribute policies that were originally designed to provision soldiers, but that later became useful in all sorts of other ways besides. It was only the Middle Ages, with their return to credit systems, that saw the first manifestations of what might be called market populism. The idea that markets could exist beyond, against, and outside of states, as in those of the Muslim Indian Ocean, an idea that was later to reappear in China with the great silver revolts of the 15th century. It usually seems to arise in situations where merchants, for one reason or another, find themselves making common cause with the common people against the administrative machinery of some great state. But market populism is always riddled with paradoxes, because it still does depend to some degree on the existence of that state, and above all, because it requires founding market relations, ultimately, in something other than sheer calculation, in the codes of honor, trust, and ultimately community and mutual aid, more typical of human economies. This, in turn, means relegating competition to a relatively minor element. In this light, we can see that what Adam Smith ultimately did in creating his debt-free market utopia was to fuse elements of this unlikely legacy with that unusually militaristic conception of the market behavior characteristic of the Christian West. In doing so, he was surely prescient. But like all extraordinarily influential writers, he was also just capturing something of the emerging spirit of his age. What we've seen ever since is an endless political jockeying back and forth between two sorts of populism, state and market populism, without anyone noticing that they were talking about the left and right flanks of exactly the same animal. The main reason that we're unable to notice, I think, is the legacy of violence that has twisted everything around us. War, conquest, and slavery not only played the central role in converting human economies into market ones, there is literally no institution in our society that has not been to some degree affected. The story told at the end of chapter 7 of how even our conceptions of freedom itself came to be transformed through the Roman institution of slavery from the ability to make friends, to enter into moral relations with others, into incoherent dreams of absolute power, is only perhaps the most dramatic instance and the most insidious, because it leaves it very hard to imagine what meaningful human freedom would even be like. If this book has shown anything, it's exactly how much violence it has taken over the course of human history to bring us to a situation where it's even possible to imagine that that's what life is really about, especially when one considers how much of our own daily experience flies directly in the face of it. As I've emphasized, communism may be the foundation of all human relations. That communism that, in our daily life, manifests itself, above all, in what we call love. But there's always some sort of system of exchange, and usually a system of hierarchy built on top of it. These systems of exchange can take an endless variety of forms, many perfectly innocuous. Still, what we're speaking of here is a very particular type of calculating exchange. As I pointed out in the very beginning, the difference between owing someone a favor and owing someone a debt is that the amount of a debt can be precisely calculated. Calculation demands equivalence. And such equivalence, especially when it involves equivalence between human beings, and it always seems to start that way, because at first human beings are always the ultimate values, only seems to occur when people have been forcibly severed from their contexts, so much so that they can be treated as identical to something else, as in 7 marten skins and 12 large silver rings for the return of your captured brother, one of your 3 daughters as surety for this loan of 150 bushels of grain. This, in turn, leads to that great embarrassing fact that haunts all human attempts to return to the market as the highest form of human freedom, that historically, impersonal commercial markets originate in theft. And on that embarrassing point for economists and for the money system and the property system in general, we're going to have to break due to time. We shall hear more from David Graeber next week. If you'd like to download this show or any previous shows, you can do so from our archive at unwelcomeguests.net. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I hope you found this show helpful in reviewing your categories of thought, and perhaps jettisoning some which are not suited to the 21st century. Prophet suggests the men that go